Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, it is. Kia ora, MOTAT, and kia ora, Marcus. We've already dispensed with some formalities. You're here, you're good.
I'm here, I'm so far good, yeah.
And we've got some science to talk about.
We do.
So the first story being about gravitational waves and what they can tell us about the universe. I guess a good place to start would be explaining gravitational waves and what causes them.
Yeah, so what the hell are gravitational waves?
That was going to be my first question. Have you ever heard of these things? Have you ever heard of these things?
I feel like in the abstract, but actually, yeah, it's good to know. I know what waves are, I know what gravity is, but together.
Okay, so Einstein did his work 100 years ago or thereabouts, and his most famous theory is general relativity. And so far, that theory has been tested many, many ways and is shown to be pretty good, pretty accurate. But one of his predictions is that when massive bodies, in other words, things that weigh an awful lot, come together and collide and crash into each other, they will propagate waves in space-time. So actual the shrinking and growing of space, just like a sound wave is a pressure wave where the air gets squished together and pulled apart, a gravitational wave is the same sort of idea, but this is in space itself. So space is actually shrinking and growing. And these the actual magnitude of these effects are absolutely tiny. We're talking a fraction of the width of a proton. And so measuring them 20 years ago was considered very, very unlikely. But about 5 years ago, a little less than 5 years ago, scientists actually made their first measurement of a gravitational wave. And they connected it with a cosmic event that happened, you know, millions of light years away, but more than likely a couple of black holes, really, really massive objects colliding and basically merging, coming together. And something as violent as that caused gravitational waves that propagated away at the speed of light. And a few million years later, they passed through the Earth. And a pair of detectors in the US plus one in Europe detected these very, very, very slight ripples in space, and they were able, because of the relative timing of these events, they were able to sort of pinpoint the location, and the shape of the wave itself actually revealed what it is had happened. And so it was a little less than 5 years ago that the first of these detections occurred, and in the next 5 years. Scientists have seen 50 observations of 50 these cosmic events, including about 39 in a six-month period in 2019, so a particularly fruitful period, but 50 in total. And the these are now, there's a growing understanding of what is happening in space and what collisions are occurring and what all these events mean. And each of them provide numerous tests of Einstein's general theory of relativity, and so far everything has held up. And the majority of the collisions are mergers of black holes. So black holes have come together and basically collided and formed just a bigger black hole, but in this tremendous release of energy has caused these gravitational waves to occur.
And so just to say, so there have been 50 over the last 5 years, does that mean that 50 have occurred, or that's just the only ones that we have been able to measure? Is this constantly?
50 have been detected. Yeah, so possibly many more have occurred, but most of these are millions and millions of light years away. These are a long, long way, and therefore they happened a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And it's taken that long for these waves to propagate through space and finally reach us. But because now we're getting some sort of a statistical survey of what's going on in the universe, what things are colliding, and you know, again, like I said, most things are black holes colliding. Occasionally, neutron stars, which are another very, very massive object, very dense, massive object, they collide. And they're more interesting because, especially interesting, because they should be associated with light emission as well. So most of the time we study the universe using radio waves and infrared light and visible light and things like that, basically parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. These gravitational waves are not part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and they provide another way, another sort of way to look at the universe, another window on the universe. And it's proving extremely interesting, and it's increasing our understanding of actually what's going on there. So some surprising discoveries. Cosmologists or astrophysicists postulated that there should be a gap in the size of black holes. So black holes that weigh between about 45 and about 130 times the mass of the sun shouldn't exist, because they postulated other processes that would get rid of them. And they've seen collisions. They've seen at least one collision of a black hole of 85 solar masses. So there's something interesting going on there.
And I think we talked about that earlier this year.
Yeah.
I think
we possibly did. Yeah.
Yeah. And so just, yeah, what's that? What's going on there?
Right. So maybe the theory's not quite right. There's something that they haven't thought of. They've been able to sort of estimate the rate at which black hole mergers are happening in a galaxy. So these things are actually more likely to occur than previously thought. The rate appears to have peaked about 8 billion years ago, and that follows a period in which stars were forming and turning into black holes. That happened about 8 billion years ago at a particularly high rate. There's also some information about how black holes spin. Most objects in space spin. The Earth spins on its axis, the Sun spins. And in binary systems, many stars exist in binary systems, so two stars orbiting each other. Mm-hmm. And if both of those stars turn into black holes, then the spins tend to be correlated. But very often, so they've seen examples of that, but they've also seen examples where the spins of the black holes are not correlated, so they're pointing in different directions. And they think that that's two black holes that have come together after they formed. So there's no correlation between how their spins should be oriented. So as we keep seeing these events, we're learning more and more about things that are happening in the cosmos.
Yeah, I've also just been looking at Felix's shirt this whole time, which is very fittingly space themed. And we will be returning to space.
For
our third story, but we've got a little interlude with the second story, which is about COVID-19 and schools and their ability to spread the virus, because I know that was a very common concern with kids returning back to school. So what has this study found?
That's right. So I haven't talked about COVID-19 for a while, but I thought I'd come back to
this. Still here.
It's still there, yeah. So anecdotally, people have been saying for a while now that children are not passing on COVID at the same rate as adults. And data gathered from studies worldwide are suggesting that schools are not particular hotspots for coronavirus infections. And despite fears, COVID-19 infections didn't surge when schools and daycare centers and kindergartens and things reopened after lockdowns. And when they did occur, when outbreaks did occur, and I think that's been borne out a little bit in New Zealand, because we've had a few events in schools in New Zealand, and they haven't, you know, caused mass spreading in a school. And it's been found that when they do occur, they mostly result in only a small number of people becoming ill. And often it's maybe one or two children, but then the families of those children, because it seems to spread to adults.
Yeah, because obviously in New Zealand, I mean, like the Marist school cluster, for example, is a big example. But that also kind of proves, because what the study shows, right, it changes as well depending on how old the kids are. So maybe because that's a high school, that is more actually goes to support what's being found. So why is it that the younger children are less likely specifically?
I think they have found that data. So children above the age of about 10 or 12 in the United States, the rate of infection is twice as high in children aged 12 to 17 as it is among 5 to 11-year-olds. And there's all sorts of data that support this. And we don't understand in detail the mechanism of transmission in children. Certainly, they've been shown to shed the virus. They catch the virus and shed viral particles. and more so in older children than younger children. But why young children seem less likely to spread coronavirus is not particularly clear at this point. One possibility is that because they have smaller lungs, which are less able to protect to project infectious aerosols than adults, and this occurs in diseases like tuberculosis. But in tuberculosis, infection is spread from lesions in the lungs, and COVID infections are different because the virus infects the upper airways. Another possibility is that children tend to transmit less virus because they're more commonly asymptomatic. Mm. And in the UK, for instance, a study of 2 to 15-year-olds, only up to about 50% of infected children develop no symptoms at all. And I think asymptomatic people tend to be less infectious. They're shedding less of the virus than symptomatic people. Mm. But overall, there's no such thing as zero transmission or zero risk. So a child that is infected can still be infectious, maybe less so, at least between children. But it seems that the risk of infection at schools is low or lower, especially when community transmission is low.
All right, well then I think we'd better return to space for our last topic, if you don't mind. We have an unfortunate incident, but it's led to a rather interesting discovery about squishy comets.
Yeah, I saw this and I thought it was quite cool. So the news in the last week or two, there's been this story of a probe, and I'm desperately trying to remember the name of it, OSIRIS-REx, I think it was, a probe that has gone to an asteroid that was floating in space, and it lowered itself down very carefully and let out a puff of gas and collected some material, and despite a little hiccup because it couldn't close its doors, it's now coming back to Earth and bringing back material from that asteroid.
I think we talked about that with Ellen.
Yeah. And that was overall, I think, a fantastic success. Now, about 6 years ago, an ESA, European Space Agency probe, landed on a comet. And this was a particularly sort of odd-shaped comet. It looked like sort of a big ball and a little ball sort of squished together.
Like a snowman.
A little bit like a snowman, yes, if you remember that. Exactly. And one of the aims for this probe was to fire a little a daughter probe down to the surface, and that would slowly lower itself down and land and drill it down a little bit and collect some material and do some studies. But unfortunately, instead of fixing itself to the surface, this little probe called Philae bounced a couple of times, landed on its side under an overhang, and basically it cut the mission short because the drill was now on its side, facing away from the surface. It couldn't do anything.
So bad news for the mission, but some good news.
Interesting news because they took a lot of photos of the surface and what happened after this little probe touched down. And by the way, it touched down. This was a crash, a collision. But under the gravity of this comet, the mass of the probe was a little under 1 gram. So it was not a big collision. It's not like a massive thing. So anyway, so they've looked very carefully at pictures of the surface of the comet and found imprints where this little guy sort of landed and then bounced on its side and then did some tumbles and bounced again. And the shape and the depth of these imprints has allowed the researchers to measure the strength of the ice beneath the comet's surface. And what they've discovered is that it is exceptionally soft. It's softer than the lightest snow. And the quote is, it's softer than the froth on your cappuccino or even the bubbles in your bubble bath. So this is incredibly soft stuff. And so they've managed to figure this out by looking at the imprints of where this thing bounced.
My snowman simile was now really appropriate because it is.
Absolutely.
Like snow.
Absolutely. So they think that Philae, this little probe, touched the surface at 4 points over about a period of about 2 minutes. So it slid down a slope, cartwheeled through a crevasse, through a crevice and hit a boulder, then bounced on its head, poor guy, before departing for its resting place, which was under this sort of overhang. And it turns out the third impact was the most revealing. The top of the craft made about a 25-centimeter deep imprint in the ice. And by comparing the depth with the time taken to make the imprint and the researchers calculated the material's compressive strength to be just 12 pascals, and that's softer than fresh fallen snow. Although the final position meant the drill on its underside never reached the comet's surface, the instrument's housing ended up penetrating the ice far enough to make some sort of similar measurements. So it seems like they've been able to probe the interior of the comet just because of the way it bounced along the surface, rather than because it actually managed to attach itself and drill down.
Right, so there is some data that can be drawn for this. And what's the significance of this, testing this ice?
Astronomers are very interested in how comets form and what they're made of. This was a fantastic opportunity to actually figure that out and to try and understand comets a bit more. Scientists were a bit disappointed when this poor little guy was bouncing over the surface. But it turns out they've managed to figure out some very interesting astronomical data.
Yeah, well, poor Philae, but...
Yeah.
Is the suggestion that all comets are like this, or is this just a special case?
I think the suggestion is that all comets are like this. I mean, they were thought of as being like giant snowballs that form out far away from in the outer reach of the solar system and then sort of fly in occasionally and get close to the sun. And the tail of the comet is material from the comet being ejected as it gets closer to the sun. So as the sun heats it up, this material starts evaporating and forms this big long tail behind the comet.
Wow.
Cool. Got any comets on that shirt? I don't think so. Lots of explosions, though.
It's the perfect thing to talk about on an audio show. Is what my t-shirt looks like.
I do love
like.
What people are wearing. All right. Well, for everyone listening, ka hoki mai mātou, amuri tēnei. We'll be right back after this. Thank you, Marcus, and thank you, Motet.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. Been